Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Amy Eddings in for Brian Lehrer on WNYCN, New Jersey Public Radio. Thanks so much for tuning in. My next guest has made a name for himself promising quick results with minimal effort. Online supplement salesman Timothy Ferris hit the big time in 2007 with his book, The 4-Hour Workweek. The bestseller is about the time famine that an increasingly online, email-inundated 25-hour culture creates and how to use that same technology to subvert it. He followed it up with another bestseller, 4-Hour Body, and now The 4-Hour Chef. It launched last Tuesday, but so far it has not landed on a lot of bookshelves. The 4-Hour Chef is one of the first books published by online retail giant Amazon and is being boycotted, by Ferris's count, by more than 1,000 brick-and-mortar stores, including Barnes & Noble. Can an online-only promotional effort yield quick results with minimal effort, or do books still need a physical shelf presence? And that so last-century relationship between publisher and retailer to get into readers' hands. Timothy Ferris joins me now. Welcome to WNYC, Tim.
Thanks for having me on.
Before we talk about the boycott, let's talk about the book. It's huge, 600-plus pages, and it's subtitled The Simple Path to Cooking Like a Pro, Learning Anything, and Living the Good Life. Why not just A Simple Path to Cooking? That sounds like enough of a challenge for non-cooks.
Right. Yeah, very narrow scope I chose. I decided to tackle this book because my readers have been asking me for a book on accelerated learning for 4 or 5 years now, and back in a former life was initially in neuroscience and then later in applied linguistics and East Asian studies at Princeton. So I'd written quite a lot on language learning, but I decided that cooking was the perfect context, not unlike Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance uses motorcycles, the perfect context for teaching learning, because I had failed at it many times before. I had quit it many times before. So I figured, what better way to showcase how the world's fastest learners learn? And I'd interviewed these people by tackling something that had beaten me before.
So here you are, you know five languages, and you've used your accelerated learning techniques to help you achieve that proficiency, those proficiencies. Why was cooking such a challenge for you?
And cooking was a challenge for a few different reasons. I've been very fortunate to spend time with people like BJ Fogg of the Persuasion Lab at Stanford University. And what you realize is cooking is not one behavior. And I think part of the reason that people fail when they try it is that it's actually, for most people, picking up not only cooking, but grocery shopping, prep time, cleanup, et cetera. And just as if you were to take, let's say, people over the age of 50 and try to teach them to quit smoking using texting, when you add it in one behavior, the failure rate just skyrockets. And so starting to look at cooking the way, let's say, a Nike Plus researcher or engineer might look at the problem just led me to believe there's probably a better way of going about learning and therefore teaching it.
Tell me about a Nike Plus researcher. What are they researching?
Well, for instance, if you look at the number of sessions that have been logged by an average user in Nike Plus, the running in this particular case becomes a habit after five sessions of data have been logged. And for that reason, if we're looking at actually solidifying behavioral change, and that applies to fat loss as well, for instance, but I want people to have five or six early wins in the very beginning to get them past the most likely period in which they would quit. And so you have things like using disposable plates for those to avoid cleanup. You have automating grocery shopping to get rid of that piece of the puzzle. And you should be able to, by removing those common failure points, get people who have never been able to stick to cooking before to actually learn to cook really, really well. And that's certainly true with fat loss. And just to give one more example, you find that when people try to lose fat and they make a New Year's resolution, they'll try to go to the gym 2-3 times a week, maybe more, change all their meals. Whereas you might want to start, which like BJ Fogg would start people with flossing one tooth a night, is 30 grams of protein within 30 minutes of waking up and not changing any meals, not going to the gym at all. And using that approach, people have lost now well over 150 pounds. And I've profiled some of them before. But it's the small things, the simple things that really work.
For the couch potatoes among us, Nike Plus is an app that helps track your physical activities and allows you to set personal goals and set training goals and improve your performance. So that's what he's talking about, what Timothy Ferris is talking about when he talks about Nike Plus. Your books are based on the Pareto principle that states roughly 80% of the effects of an effort comes from 20% of the causes. So 20% effort for 80% results. How did you apply that to cooking?
The way that I applied that to cooking was interviewing culinary school instructors and chefs to try to identify, for instance, the techniques, the actual cooking techniques, not necessarily recipes, but techniques like braising, for instance, that allow you to access all of the world's cuisines or that have the largest margin of safety. So, you know, borrowing from Warren Buffett in a sense on this one, but picking the techniques and recipes that allow the largest number of mistakes but still produce good results. That also applies to cooking gear, for instance. There are a lot of tools that professional chefs use that are not necessarily expensive, like a microplane, like lint-free surgical Huck towels. So the blue towels that are common in hospitals, a number of chefs have adopted for all sorts of different uses, that allow you to, with a very minimal budget, to produce pretty much anything you would want to recreate in most recipe books. That would not apply to certain things like the French Laundry, of course, but broadly speaking, with very few tools and very few techniques, you can really create thousands and thousands of incredible dishes. So that would be one way that you could apply it to cooking.
Why should people learn how to do sous vide or some of the more complicated culinary skills that you have documented in your book, especially your target audience, young men? What is I can understand the four-hour body. Everybody wants to look buff and great, and there's a lot of social pressure for that. But less social pressure, especially for young men, I think, to learn how to cook. So what's the benefit there?
Yeah, this is definitely the most challenging book from that standpoint. But I think so selling cooking as the sort of Trojan horse for learning how to learn, I think, is how you get young men to pick it up. But my audience is, I would say, 60, based on Facebook analytics, at least 60% male, 40% female. But they do tend to skew on the younger side. So I would say that the way that I push cooking is, number one, I would say, even if you only experiment with cooking the way I lay it out for a week, let's say, your experience of eating will go from, at least, and this is my case, from black and white to HD in a million colors resolution in terms of your actual ability to enjoy and discern flavor, number one. Number two, that by tackling a skill that engages all five senses, you're able to improve all of those senses and apply them to other things, whether it's basketball, whether it is language acquisition, all of the same. There's a lot of transfer is what I would say with cooking, and that was one of the most surprising things to me. And then thirdly, I would say as far as the good life goes, whether it's, you know, looking for mating advantage or just looking at self-reported well-being, which is a fancy way of saying happiness, when you look at people like Marty Seligman, for instance, long meal time. Long meals with friends and family two or three times a week solves a lot of problems. It's actually also a really very good predictor of marriage success. So those would be a few of the reasons that people who normally would not cook might find cooking, or at least hopefully this approach to cooking, interesting.
I'm speaking with Timothy Ferris, the author of The 4-Hour Chef. It's published by New Harvest, an imprint of Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, under an arrangement with Amazon Publishing, one of the first books that Amazon has published, and that has provoked something of a controversy. Barnes & Noble and other brick-and-mortar stores saying that they will not sell any book published by Amazon because they feel it's giving shelf space to a competitor that wants to drive them out of business with their huge online marketing presence. Let's talk about that publishing aspect of your book. And listeners, if you're in the publishing industry, I'm interested in getting your calls. 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. Have you been following this in the publishing industry and the battle between Amazon and brick-and-mortar stores? Have you been following the fate of Timothy Ferris's book? And what do you make of it? 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. When you announced you were going with Amazon for the 4-Hour Chef, you told the New York Times, quote, "I don't feel like I'm giving up anything financially or otherwise by signing with Amazon." Do you still feel that way now that the book has been is not being offered for, you know, I can't see it when I walk into a Barnes & Noble bookstore. It's not there with the holiday ornaments and all the glitter and trappings that might lead me to look at it and leaf through it. You've had to do an enormous amount of promotional effort online with your own blog. Would you backtrack from that statement, or you still feel that way, that you haven't you didn't give up anything?
No, I still feel the same way. And the conversations about the potential of a boycott were had with my agent Steve Hanselman, for instance, well in advance of finalizing the deals with Amazon. And the decision was fundamentally one of choosing a technology company, a world-class technology company that was trying to reinvent publishing, or very good publishers. I did have a good experience with Crown, within Random House, who were trying to embrace technology. And the sentiment or the perspective that I had was, even if I do not sell a single print copy, I want the opportunity to be the first and to experiment in new ways. That was really what I wanted to do. Now, will that potentially affect, let's say, the New York Times list? Absolutely. And I think that's part of the reason that Barnes & Noble does have a big club to swing at someone like me to potentially make an example out of me and scare away other authors, because the New York Times list depends on, in large part, on a variety of reporting sources, including at retail. But I'm happy with the decision. And something that hasn't been talked about is the fact that it's a 672 full color book that's selling for $21 as a physical book. And that I cannot think of
on Amazon. At an independent bookseller, you'd be paying $35 list price,
right,
for that book. So,
but despite the retail price, whichever it is, just on a sheer production scale, there are very few publishers who would put that type of book together and then put the marketing behind it. There are some really good publishers like Faden, that put out very beautiful books. And I think they'll actually last longer in this industry than most publishers, precisely because they offer a unique tactile experience. But it's been a roller coaster. I'm not going to lie. Certainly it has been a roller coaster, but I do not regret the decision and would stand behind what I said before.
You wrote on your blog recently that your book is a sniper shot directed at the heart of every member of the publishing oligarchy, not all publishers, mind you, who cares more about their parking spot at their country club than their end user, the reader. How so? Is this really about the reader? After all, it's not like potential customers cannot find your book. It's not banned.
Well, it is about the customer. And what I would say is I've written on the blog, for instance, since 2007. It's always been free, 400-plus articles. So I do spend a lot of time with my readers. I mean, about 1.2 million uniques a month now, and I do get a lot of feedback on not only what I should create, what I should write, but what types of problems I want fixed. And the attraction that I had to – let me take a step back. If you think about traditional publishing – in terms of distribution, is a business-to-business company. You have the VP of sales at, let's say, Simon & Schuster Imprint, that then sells to the head category buyer at Barnes & Noble, the head category buyer at Books A Million, the head category buyer at Fulton Blank. They do not have direct relationships with their customers. And Amazon does. I mean, in a way, given, for instance, the way I use Amazon Prime, they probably know me better than I know myself in certain respects. And it was very attractive to me to be able to communicate directly with the readers that I wanted to reach, including my own. But
at the same time, you wrote on your blog that independent bookstores are starting to pick up 4-Hour Chef, and you said it's exactly where I want a 600-plus page full-color book. Why? First of all, they're the ones being hurt the most by Amazon and its ability to sell your $35 book for currently $21 or $5 on Kindle. And secondly, you're saying that in many ways you don't really need them because of what Amazon is able to provide in terms of its reach and the metrics it's able to provide you as an author of where your book is being sold.
Yeah, I don't think there's a contradiction. I mean, the I want the book sold where people can see it because it is presented to something. The New York Times also said it's precisely the type of physical, like beautiful physical holiday book that independent booksellers would usually rally behind during this time of year. I do absolutely empathize with the challenge in selling a book at retail that sells on Amazon for effectively wholesale price. But the point I would make as well is that the battle is not with Amazon Publishing. I think that there's a case of mistaken identity in many cases where people are looking at the transition to digital, the ability to sell books on Kindle for $5 or on iTunes for 99 cents, and seeing me as a representative of that. But even if this book fails, even if Amazon Publishing fails, it's ultimately consumer demand for greater selection, lower prices, faster delivery that is moving things towards digital. So I don't think that it's necessarily, I mean, I wish I could take credit for all the digital innovation out there, but it's just not the case. And there's a lot of disruption given Moore's Law and the development of technology. So, you know, I'm involved with a lot of startups like Uber, Evernote, StumbleUpon, and so on. And I think this publishing has had a relatively easy time of things while the music industry and film and whatnot have all been disrupted in major, major ways. And I think that it's just a matter of time. It has just been a matter of time before those things started to affect the economics of, say, independent bookstores. But there will be survivors and people who succeed in independent bookstores like Omnivore Books in San Francisco, All Cookbooks. There are benefits that bookstore offers that I cannot replicate on Amazon. But I think that people need to adapt. I can't. It's tough to see businesses go out of business, but it's not my goal to put them out of business, certainly.
Barbara from the East Village, you're on WNYC with the 4-Hour Chef's Timothy Ferris. Hi, Barbara. Barbara, are you there? Hi, Barbara.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. What's your question?
Yeah, just wondering if you think that Barnes & Noble stands to not sell Amazon Amazon Books as a sustainable one, given the increasing reach and power of Amazon with publishers. In addition, Barnes & Noble has a bigger problem, which is what to do with their brick-and-mortar stores and all the space allotted to these physical books. There's so many larger issues attached to this. The smaller issue, it seems.
Yeah, absolutely. Amy, do you mind if I...
Sure, go ahead. Jump in.
That? So I would say that, I mean, the Barnes & Noble is in a tight spot. I mean, they've spun off the Nook with separate investment from Microsoft. And even last week, the CEO of Barnes & Noble was effectively quoted as saying, I don't read any print books anymore. So the question is, you know, how does then that same CEO retain customers who are like him? And I think that I would love to see their 20-year strategy. I don't know what it is. I mean, it's an expensive business to own and operate. So I think that this launch, I mean, I've been criticized by making this sort of an us versus them type of thing, or a content creator versus incumbent distribution. But I don't think it's that. I don't think it's exaggerated. I think that I know for a fact there are authors watching this. I know for a fact distributors are watching this. And I think that it is representative of larger changes, certainly in tech, and that Barnes & Noble is going to have to contend with whether I succeed or not.
I wanted to end with this, Timothy, just some positioning here. You're ranked number 16 in books on Amazon right now, number 2 in cookbooks, food and wine. You're the number 17 book in the Kindle store. David Streitfeld of the New York Times wrote that what the launch and marketing of your book and the fight between Amazon and Barnes & Noble portends is a trend in publishing that everything will be a bestseller even if you have to give it away. You want 4-Hour Chef to be the first nonfiction book to sell 1 million copies on Kindle. Streitfeld thinks you and Amazon will keep lowering the price until you get there. Is he right about that?
I haven't heard anything from Amazon to indicate that, but books are hard, and I would say content is hard. So, I mean, David can paint it as easy, but even for Amazon, I think, as has been shown with Penny Marshall, like book creation and distribution is a tough business. And as the barriers to entry decrease, you're going to have more competition, more noise, and the ability to get above that noise with quality of content as well as marketing and promotion is only going to get harder. So I don't think it's as easy as he paints it to be. I mean, I've had 2 number one New York Times bestsellers, and this book launch has still been a struggle, but it's always a struggle, and I think it will always continue to be a struggle. So I expect it, but I don't think Amazon's just going to give everything away forever simply out of bestsellers, because they recognize as well as everyone else that that would be transparent and people would discount it. So I'm in it for the long haul, but it's certainly a dogfight.
Timothy Ferris, author of The 4-Hour Chef. Well, you hold the Guinness World Record for tango spin, so I know you have the endurance and the stamina to keep up with the dogfight, Tim. Timothy Ferris, thank you so much for joining me on The Brian Lehrer Show.
Thank you for having me.
This is WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. Amy Eddings in for Brian Lehrer. Coming up, let's take a holiday shopping survey. Did you shop on Thanksgiving? Are you online shopping today for Cyber Monday? Did you support small businesses on Saturday? Call now 212-433-WNYC with your report on shopping. Derek Thompson from The Atlantic will be with me to discuss the trends. Call now 212-433-WNYC. We'll be right back.